All right, so welcome to another Academic Agent Retrospective. This is volume 17. It's called Sensibly Centered, and it chronicles the genesis of the sensible center kind of movement or framing that I talked about last year, over a year ago now. And also collect a couple of other videos, the one on Zoomers, as well as as a little bonus, reaction video, which is actually the only video I have ever appeared in with my actual face. Obviously, I've done interviews and things on other channels, but in terms of videos on my own channel, that is basically the only face reveal, that came out a few months ago now. Now, speaking of my many run-ins and my expansive rogues gallery, my video Against Ideology triggered a response from Keith Woods, which was called Against Academic Agent. I know I never bothered watching that video because for other reasons, I have reason to cut my ties with Keith altogether, as everybody knows. We need not go into that here. I did actually respond, in a sense, to the critics of that Against Ideology video on my Substack, which you can see here. I stand by it, of course. It's actually a core belief of mine, which, as I talked about on a recent video, you can go through all my work. I believe the intuition comes first and reasoning follows, and that most ideologies are post hoc rationalizations. And that's a good reason, I think, to adopt the sensible center framing, right? Remember, I put these retrospectives together. I mean, they're almost like kind of box sets or something, but it is for posterity. So that should you ever need some sort of archive of my videos, they're all together in one place. All right. Hope you enjoy this one. And friends, stay sensible, stay centered. This cathedral has stood for over 900 years. It was built painstakingly, stone by stone, using materials cut from the cliffs below. Many of the men who worked on this colossal project did not see it finished in the 40 years it took to complete. They were fortunate enough to have contributed to something bigger than themselves, and we still live with their legacy. Whether viewed from the exterior or the interior, this building can inspire awe, beauty, a feeling of transcendence and faith. It looks upwards, it reaches for more. Now consider the mentality that created this building, or perhaps this one. Not only will these buildings not inspire awe, beauty, transcendence, or faith, they will also likely bring you down and leave you feeling depressed, sapping the life and soul out of you. How did we go from this to this? From this to this. I have often said that I'd settle for a sensible government, but what exactly would such a government look like? In this new mini-series, I'm going to flesh out a few key policy areas which could help to make our government in Britain more sensible. But first, what is the overriding philosophy behind this forthcoming set of policy proposals? I think the basic problem with how things are at the moment was summed up recently by Neil Oliver. He said, "We are no longer being treated as individuals entitled to try to make the most of our lives, but as a barn full of battery hens, just another product to be bought and sold down the river." Oliver's concern is not new, but has echoed right through British intellectual history, not just by Jeremy Corbyn or Karl Marx, but also by many of our greatest writers, such as Geoffrey Chaucer, William Shakespeare, William Blake, Thomas Carlyle, Charles Dickens, and indeed by Peter Gabriel era Genesis, among countless others. In a society driven by profit, the bottom line becomes the only consideration. Oh, I'm sorry. That church that has stood here for 200 years can't stay open. There's not enough money. We need to make room for another Starbucks. There's not enough demand for libraries. This real estate would be better used to erect yet another set of luxury apartments. The rule of supply and demand always gives way, as Carlyle put it, to the doctrine of cash payment, which becomes the universal soul nexus of man to man, replacing all other meaningful social bonds. There can be no higher ideals or values because everything is a utilitarian calculation. A morally bankrupt materialism pervades everything, no matter if it is controlled by private enterprise or indeed by the state. Our society is much too dominated by those who ask, "What's in it for me?" Concepts like duty and the common good are almost alien and even labelled as obsolete by some writers. Back when the USA had leaders of which that nation could be proud, the president once said, "Ask not what your nation can do for you, but what you can do for your nation." We are used to thinking of those serving in the army as doing their duty for the country. But in a well-ordered society, this sense of duty would extend to all jobs and all walks of life, all playing their part, doing their bit for the greater good. But herein lies another problem. There is no longer the concept of a community or even a nation. Instead, as articulated recently by Paul Joseph Watson, heritage institutions now exist to desecrate our heritage. Cultural institutions now exist to recolonize our culture. Historical institutions now exist to humiliate our ancestors. This is the net result of a materialist vision of the world that worships GDP and the line going up, and which, in its thirst to break down all barriers to trade and migration to lower costs, is willing to embrace any ideology, no matter how toxic, to achieve its ends. The bottom line doesn't understand history or nationhood or culture or the qualitative and meaningful differences between people. In fact, it hates those things and sees them as obstacles to be torn down. But we need an economy that works for the benefit of our nation and its people, not one that seeks to transform those people into interchangeable units for its own mindless mechanisms. We need a way of seeing the world that replaces the notion of Britain as an economic zone, Great Britain PLC, with a vision rooted in history in which British people can feel pride. The mantra of line goes up must be replaced with something like, "For the glory of Albion." The central logic of everything we do should be the betterment of the nation and its people, not for the betterment of the spreadsheets of faceless multinational corporations and banks that hate you. For most of our lives, we have been told to accept flagrant neoliberal lies about how maintaining open borders and nearly unlimited immigration is good for the economy. We have been told that surrendering our manufacturing capacity for free and easy trade with China and other nations makes for a more prosperous life. And expert economists will present you reams of data to show the success of this project. But wages have stagnated. Where once a working man on a single wage could support a whole family and live in a house, Now, men and women on joint full-time incomes can scarcely afford to have children until they are in their 30s. You can go back and see how people lived in the 1950s and the 1960s. Working class families lived in houses. A bus driver could afford to live in a place like this. This house was featured in the early 1970s TV series On the Buses, when it was believable that men such as this could afford to live in a place such as this on just one salary. Now, I have checked this street for house prices today, and according to Rightmove, the average cost of a house down this street today is over £450,000. In 1970, someone like Blakey here would have earned around £1,000 a year, and a house down this exact street would have cost around £4,000, just above the national average, which was about £3,500 back then. In other words, this house, was four times Blakey's salary. Today, a London bus driver earns around £28,000 a year. And this same house is now 16 times his salary. In other words, he can no longer afford to live here. It's far outside his reach now, as professionals have been pushed out here after the places that they would have once lived in central London, have been sold to Russians or Saudi Arabians, who care so little about this nation that they don't even live in such houses. Or else, the houses have been sold to grubby real estate firms and turned into yet more luxury apartments available for £3,500 a month. And again, well outside the pay bracket of Blakey and Co. But chin up, Blakey. At least you can watch football on Sky Sports, endless crap on Netflix, and get a McDonald's delivered to your door by a shady Albanian. In the coming weeks, I will outline my proposals to fix this situation in the following areas: citizenship and immigration, the economy, housing, infrastructure, and education. I will aim to bring out these videos every Thursday around the same time. Do pick up one of my courses. The Trivium alone will teach you more than most classes you ever took in our sorry excuse for an education system. Remember also that my summer sale is still on, 25% off all courses using promo code Scorcher. Till next time. Get out. In this video, the second in my series on proposals for a sensible British government, I am going to tackle the questions of citizenship and immigration. In order to do this, I propose four acts: the British National Citizenship Act, the British National Capital Act, the British National Companies Act, and the British National Workers Act. Let me talk through these in turn. In the videos that follow in this series, the category of British national is going to be very important. So the sensible government of Britain has to define what that means, and this is the purpose of the National Citizenship Act. Currently, you can become a UK citizen by being born in the UK, marrying a British citizen, and living in the UK for 3 years, or living in the UK for 5 years. There are also some other minor paths, including having a British parent, being from Gibraltar or Hong Kong, currently being stateless, having previously renounced your citizenship, and finally, some other special circumstances we need not get into. In addition to all of that, you have to pass Gordon Brown's UK citizenship test, which is known as the Life in the UK test. This was designed by the late Bernard Crick, who was, among other things, an expert on George Orwell, As ever, the Tory party have done nothing whatsoever to change New Labour's plans in the past 12 years, so as far as I can tell, the Blair-Brown citizenship rules have remained in place. The first thing that interests me here is that the concept of renouncing citizenship exists in law already. One issue that we have currently is the problem of dual loyalty, which is to say that immigrants coming here remain more loyal to their country of origin than to Britain. There are many countries in the world that do not accept dual citizenship. For example, Japan. If you adopt a second nationality, the Japanese government gives the person until they are 22 to decide their loyalty. But you must choose one. Singapore has even more strict rules than that. The Netherlands also has, curiously, stringent laws on this. And other than through marriage, you cannot be a Dutch dual citizen. China does not allow its own citizens to adopt a second nationality. And if they do, they automatically lose Chinese citizenship. Places like Kuwait and Nepal also have particularly strict dual citizenship laws. In other words, there are lots of modern countries all over the world where the precedent exists for stricter laws than the UK currently has. I think it would help curb immigration and to promote social cohesion somewhat if all naturalised UK citizens had to renounce their country of origin in order to obtain a British passport. You're either loyal to Britain or you are not. There can be no first and second ranks in loyalty. Second, it is clear already, even according to British law as it stands today, that blood means something. Otherwise, the caveat of having a British parent would not be there in the first place. And I would like to make this stricter by introducing a point scheme that might look like this. Effectively, what this is looking for is evidence of at least three generations tying the person to the country. This is designed to prevent the rapid naturalisation of vast swathes of people who bring their entire families here. Finally, I want to eliminate being born here granting someone automatic right to British citizenship. This can be too easily gamed. All it takes is for someone to get here and give birth, and then they've secured their child a golden ticket. And that seems much too lenient to me. Even a newborn would need to have a positive score on this table to be eligible for citizenship. This is a basic protection against organised hostile takeover by any foreign group. At present, there is nothing stopping another group coming here and simply taking over through just giving birth to more and more kids. This act would put an end to that. Now, these changes, which I've listed here, would make people take the category of what it means to be British much more seriously, as well as removing some of the key incentives of people coming here in the first place. Now, before I talk about the next three acts, let me explain what my overall aim in introducing them is. First, here is Ludwig von Mises on Ricardo's Law of Association, also known as the Law of Comparative Advantage, which is the primary argument for international free trade in economics. If you've studied economics at any level, you will be familiar with Ricardo's Law of Association. Ricardo showed that under certain conditions, it was always beneficial to trade so as to increase specialisation under the division of labour. But as Mises notes, and this is highlighted in the text here, he, that is Ricardo, investigated the effects of trade between two areas unequally endowed by nature, and this is really important, under the assumption that the products, but not the workers, and the accumulated factors of future production, i.e. capital goods, can freely move from each area into the other. In other words, in classic free trade theory, there is movement of goods and services, but not of labour and capital. That is, labor and capital are constant. They're held constant in each nation. They're fixed, in other words. Mises repeats this later. He says that Ricardo starts from the assumption that there is mobility of capital and labor only within each country and not between the various countries. He raises the question what the consequences of the free mobility of products must be under such conditions. The theory of comparative cost answers this question. Now, Ricardo's assumptions, by and large, held good for his age. Later, in the course of the 19th century, conditions changed. The immobility of capital and labour gave way. International transfer of capital and labour became more and more common. Then came a reaction. Today, capital and labour are again restricted in their mobility. Reality again corresponds to the Ricardian assumptions. Thus, by Mises' own admission, when the constants in Ricardo's assumptions no longer held, that is, when labour and capital became mobile, the reaction of nations around the world was to prevent them from being so again. Because, simply put, if labour and capital are mobile, you don't have a nation. Mises, writing in 1949, was arguing to open up the free trade of goods and services because the events of the two world wars had once again restricted capital and labour. But since they have opened up again now in 2022, we face the same situation that they did in the late 19th century, but before the two world wars, namely the unchecked flow of capital and labour. And my measures, the three acts I'm about to talk about, seek to remedy this by returning the mobility of capital and labour back to their historical norm, thereby making free trade, as defined by Ricardo and Mises, once again viable. So, the British National Capital Act would ban British nationals from sending money abroad, and it would mandate that they can only invest in UK companies. If either of these two laws were violated, it would result in revoked citizenship. The purposes of this law are twofold. First, it is to prevent the decades-long practice of foreign nationals coming to this country and then sending all their earnings to their family in their country of origin. Second, it is to prevent British nationals enriching themselves for the benefit of a foreign nation rather than for their own. The duty of a British national is first to his fellow countrymen. All his actions should be for their betterment, and frankly, investing in a software firm in Silicon Valley or a copper mine in Chile does not obviously benefit the people of Britain. The London Stock Exchange would be limited only to UK companies. While on the face of it, this would look like it would be doing billions of pounds of damage to the UK economy, in practice, virtually no one in the real economy would be affected. Maybe it would result in one less house for Jacob Rees-Mogg, who made all his money investing in foreign markets. Secondly, we would pass the British Companies Act. This states that all companies operating in the UK must be owned by British nationals. Foreign-owned companies with headquarters in another country, if they want to keep on operating in Britain, must establish a British-owned separate entity to operate in the UK. For example, Google UK. This steelworks should not be run by Tata, an Indian company, a foreign company. It must be British-owned. If the company cannot name a British owner for their new entity, it will either be nationalised or auctioned off to the highest British bidder. Or it could be nationalised for a period and then auctioned off. This act effectively bans foreign direct investment in the UK, although there is still a way for foreign companies to invest so long as they set up a British-owned separate entity as outlined above. The combination of the British Capital Act and the British Companies Act would put an end to the free flow of capital in and out of Britain. To go back to David Ricardo, this means that when a factory closes down, let us say because Portugal or France is making that good for a better price now, the capital must be reallocated within the UK, not used to set up a new factory in Mexico, China, or India, or anywhere else. The capital must stay here, and it must be used to build manufacturing capacity, infrastructure, and other such things for the benefit of British nationals and not for the benefit of some other nation. Third, the British National Workers Act would mandate that UK companies must hire British workers in all cases where it is theoretically possible, as demonstrated by local unemployment numbers. If a UK company can show there are no British workers after a really concerted effort, then the foreign worker must be paid the same wage as the British worker would have been. The aim of this policy is to cut the incentives for immigration in the first place. However, a secondary aim is to put a stop once and for all to the shady practices of shysters like Mike Ashley here, who has operated with virtual slave labour in all but name. If British workers won't get out of bed for less than a certain amount, then whatever that amount is the market rate of the wages. Wages have to be set by what people are willing to get out of bed for, not by Mike Ashley's concerns about his costs. Our leaders do everything humanly possible to keep wages low. But as we saw last time, that means, in real terms, workers are about four times worse off than they were in 1970, if you include the cost of housing. So there it is. Let me know what you think of my proposals. Remember, promo code SCORCHER gets 25% off all courses at the academic agency at the moment, and that offer is on for the rest of August. Now get out. In this video, I want to lay out the case for why ideology does not really matter half as much as everybody thinks it does. Vilfredo Pareto wrote a very long and complex book in 1916 called The Mind and Society, which contains the bulk of his contributions to what is called elite theory today. If you'd like to know more about that in detail, I'd recommend taking my course, Foundations of Politics, and picking up the textbook for that course, The Populist Illusion. Here, I am going to try to keep things super simple and focus on just one of Pareto's ideas, that most of our written laws, and before that our ideas, are post hoc rationalisations of what he calls sentiments. We might just say instincts. Human behaviour is fundamentally non-logical, yet there is a deep-seated human need to appear rational. Thus humans act and then generate arguments to justify those actions after the fact. This idea was lent a lot of weight by empirical research almost a century after Pareto was writing, which is summarised in popular books such as Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow and Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. However, where researchers such as Kahneman and Haidt draw these conclusions at the level of individual decision-making, Pareto is talking about society-wide decisions as embodied in the actions of those in power, also known as the elites. When it comes to power, there are only really two arguments. For the sake of simplicity, let me summarise the first as follows. BS, 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 therefore we should rule. This argument we can call, following another elite theorist, Gaetano Mosca, the political formula of any regime. However, for practical purposes in the running of things, those in power need a second argument. BS, 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 BS. Therefore, we were correct to follow our course of action. Now, since for Pareto, societies are defined entirely by their elites, all other arguments besides those made by power in the service of their own power are essentially noise. Note that both these arguments take place after a group is already in power and after that group has already acted. The action comes first and the argument follows in both cases. Why should you be king, Charlemagne? Is it because you crushed all your rivals with sword and lance? No. It's because I was sent by God. Okay then. God save the king. Henry, why should you be the head of the church then and not the pope? Is it because you wanted to marry Anne Boleyn or something like that? Oh no, it's because I was sent by God. I don't know, go and read Martin Luther or something. Just go away. So, Vladimir, aren't you basically an autocratic dictator? What happened to the rule by the workers? The dictatorship of the proletariat is vested in me, and this is a necessary phase in order to get to true communism or something. Also, we need to hire some managers because workers don't know what they're doing. Okay, enough questions. Go directly to Gulag. Hey, Tone! Why are all our leaders just versions of you, glorified managers, then? The future is inevitable, and you can either be on the right side of it or get left behind. Let's not waste time with politics and just get on with what needs to be done. Oh, all right then. God save the king. You can have hours of fun doing your own version of this, but in the end, you'll see that every argument either has the form, BSBS, BSBS, therefore we should rule, or BSBS, BSBS, therefore we were correct to follow our course of action. Now, those of you of a more ideological bent might be screaming at your monitors. You might be saying things like, the BS matters, AA, the BS matters, which is to say that the content of the BS has a real effect on the world. And this is true. But the content of the BS is generated entirely by the question of which group is in power. The divine right of kings means, in the end, that whatever Charlemagne or King Henry here says goes. Likewise, communism was, in the final analysis, whatever Lenin or later Stalin said it was. And, by exactly the same token, liberal democracy is whatever Tony Blair and his friends decide it is on any given news cycle. Things they want are liberal democracy, and things they don't want are a threat to democracy. This is the true nature of power. What any ruling class wants will be driven primarily by the maintenance and expansion of their own power. Thus, when the managerial class invent invisible enemies like racism or sexism or terror or climate change or COVID-19 or whatever else, the net effect is always expansion of managerial control. When James I of England, also known as James VI of Scotland, wrote his The True Law of Free Monarchy, he argued, surprise, surprise, that there should be basically no checks on his power. In a sense, James was more honest than most leaders who try to dress up their post hoc justifications for power with legalism. Such was the case with William of Orange, who invaded England in 1688, a foreign power, mind you, and then reached for the nearest copy of John Locke's works to justify his rule. If the other side had won, they'd have likely reached for James I's old books, which, in fact, James II did do when he was the king, or maybe he'd have reached for Robert Filmer or Thomas Hobbes or whatever else. But William of Orange did not invade England because he was a staunch Lockean or for any ideological reasons at all. He did it because he sought a geostrategic position against the French and, well, because he could. He simply had the power to, especially because James II had a good number of enemies at home. But whether they reached for their Robert Filmer or for their John Locke, both sides in the struggle of the Glorious Revolution had the same argument. BSBS, BSBS, therefore we should rule. William of Orange, signing the Bill of Rights in 1689 was simply the formalization of the fact that power would be handed to the parliamentarians who backed him, granting MPs such rights as parliamentary privilege or what Herbert Spencer would later call accurately the divine right of Parliament. In a recent Substack article called Ideas Have Consequences, Mike from Imperium Press, which published my best-selling book, The Populist Illusion, Buy It Now, recognised this fact that I've been talking about by pointing out some cold, hard truths to people who don't want to hear it. It's worth quoting him at length. There's a view implicit in much modern thought that we could call the Hesiodic view of history, that ideas start out pure and only later become corrupted. Often this view is applied to things that are quasi-religious. The Enlightenment, in the eyes of Steven Pinker, was a miraculous, sui generis event that issued from we know not where, because the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, or something. We just kind of forgot how to be liberal, and now the horizon is darkened by the looming spectres of communism and fascism. Apart from the fact that any idea whose price is eternal vigilance is weak and unnatural, this view is contradicted at every step by the actual history of ideas. Religions, ideologies, movements, value systems, these don't always or even usually start out pure and become corrupted over time. Ideologies start out beholden to circumstances, and as those circumstances change, the ideology either adapts itself to those circumstances or it dies. In fact, most of the time, we see the precise opposite of the Hesiodic view. Ideologies very often start out as malleable and heterogeneous, then rid themselves of their impure elements and become more fixed and internally coherent over time. As the ideology consolidates power, it gains influence over just those circumstances to which it was beholden. It can increasingly influence those circumstances more than it is influenced by them. The early NSDAP, which is to say the German National Socialists or the Nazis in the vernacular, with membership not much over 50, was not in a position to influence much of anything. And at this early stage, its ideas were very much in flux. These few dozen men, meeting in a beer hall, had a worldview much less settled than did the fully consolidated Reich, with its strict command structure, party offices, parliamentary groups, and media apparatus. National Socialism was a worldview in the process of development, a process which was not yet worked out at the time of its destruction, to say nothing of its infancy. So if we are to look for authentic National Socialist orthodoxy, we must look primarily to the post-consolidation era. If the worry is that power struggles contaminate ideological purity, look to the shape of the ideology when the struggles were more or less over. Had Germany won the war, you would have seen yet more consistent and purist National Socialism, just as you did with liberal democracy. Liberalism was never more liberal than when all its enemies had been destroyed at the end of history. This is troubling to the likes of Jordan Peterson and Steven Pinker, who try to draw a line between embryonic liberalism and mature liberalism. But this is simply not tenable. This is not a historical rule. Sometimes revolution does sunder the father from the son, as happened in the classical world vis-a-vis the archaic world. But in the case of National Socialism and contemporary liberalism, there can be no question. The end was the fulfillment and not the rejection of the beginning. Now, another way of saying all this is that no ideology survives contact with reality for long, unaltered, and will only fully realise itself in practice rather than in theory. When Benito Mussolini marched on Rome in 1922, he did not lay out the principles of fascism from A to Z. In fact, the true shape of fascism would not be formalised for several years after he took power. He said only, and I quote, "Our program is simple. We want to rule Italy." Now, say what you want about Mussolini, but like James I, he was more honest than most leaders. This is one of several reasons behind why I have focused on what I have called the negative vision, or clear them out, than I have on perfecting so-called ideology, which in the end does not matter in the slightest, since it is downstream of power. The real and ultimate question concerns who is in power, which people and which groups, not how they justify their rule or their actions. If the current elites were replaced by us, or by people like us, all else would flow from there. We would post hoc justify our rule and our actions in the same way as all other regimes throughout history have done. But by the very virtue of being different, and a different set of people from those who currently rule, we would do different things and come up with different BS for why. I appreciate that this is a difficult thing to accept. How can ideology simply not matter? It seems so counterintuitive. And people who have an ideology to sell, be it white nationalism or third positionism or orthodox Christianity or, you know, fifth dimensional recreated paganism or whatever else, will tell you to reject what I am saying, because their BS matters more than the observed reality of power to them. They will make moralistic and idealistic arguments about the motives of those who seek power, which can be summed up with a single word: cope. Let me give an example. I will not embarrass the author by naming him, because he is young and might one day learn to accept reality as it is rather than how he dreams it ought to be in a world that has never existed. He says, "Why do you want what you want, though? Why does anyone want what they want? Are the reins of power solely going to be in the hands of sociopathic narcissists who like to coerce to get what they want? Or are the elite theorists themselves just projecting their own sociopathic narcissism onto the concept of power and perceive it purely as a means to obtain golden glory? The very idea of power being solely in the hands of the few leaves out an important part of why for obtaining power, which puts this theory in a tizzy. If your why is selfish, your reign of power will be hellish." Now, first off, ignore the definition of the iron law of oligarchy given. This is plainly someone who has not studied Robert Michel's. And again, I encourage you to take Foundations of Politics and to read The Populist Delusion for a more accurate understanding of what the iron law of oligarchy actually is. But second, and much more importantly, this author is doing his best to deny the fact of what Nietzsche called will to power. Let us return to the quotation by Mussolini. He said, "Our program is simple. We wish to govern Italy. They ask us for programs, but there are already too many. It is not programs that are wanting for the salvation of Italy, but men and willpower." He needed no other arguments than the current leaders are bad and Italy needs saving. We are the men to do it. This is the will to power. No one seeks transformational power, which is to say, one that affects a true circulation of elites, for selfish reasons. By definition, selfish careerists will follow the status quo and not seek its overthrow. People like Wormtongue, for example, would never take a stand like Benito Mussolini did. The iron law of oligarchy is such that seeking reform within the system as it stands, that is, without enacting a circulation of the elites, will result not in you changing the system, but in the system changing you. I'll repeat, you will not change the system will change you. That's the iron law of oligarchy. This is precisely why Robert Michel's the man who coined this idea, ended up supporting a man like Mussolini and not the Liberal Union or any of the other establishment parties in Italy at that time. Now, none of this is to say that ideology does not matter at all. Of course, it does shape the world around us. But rather to point out that it is always downstream of power and its interests. So that unless your ideology happens to align with those interests, it will not be selected by power. Unless, that is, you become the power. But in that case, as I have already said, your ideology will not survive contact with reality for long anyway. It will turn into something else, as fascism was quite different in, let's say, 1930 than it was in 1922. So saying that ideology shapes the world around you simply says, if you want to take it down to ultimate causes, power shapes the world around us. Liberal democracy in the 19th century meant free trade and voluntary association and the spirit of laissez-faire. But this was only because free trade suited the British Empire. Britain was the first shipping nation, the leading industrial economy, the supreme naval power, and the largest colonial network. Advocacy for free trade in Britain was little more than a disguised request for free commercial enterprise to the whole world, including territories controlled by their rivals. Classical liberalism was the post hoc justification for all of this. In fact, the British Empire was straightforwardly mercantilist and protectionist until at least about 1846. The repeal of the Corn Laws represented the final defeat of the old landed aristocracy, who represented rural and agricultural Britain. The period of laissez-faire effectively ended by about 1890, when it was no longer politically expedient to support it. The British Empire was run by industrialists, principally for industrialists, and so liberal democracy reflected this. When managerialism took root, the USA, which had taken over as world hegemon by that point, was run by managers, principally for managers, and so liberal democracy reflected this. Managerialism loves the invisible war, as I've already alluded to. The war on poverty, the war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on COVID-19, the war on racism, the war on sexism, the war on homophobia, the war on transphobia, the war on climate change, and so on and so forth ad nauseum. It does it because each ratchet enlarges the scope of its power and its control. Liberal democracy will be this until it is no longer politically expedient for it to be so, and then it will become something else again, or else until those in power decide to dispense with liberal democracy altogether, in which case we will have true circulation of elites, as I've alluded to. Hopefully this has given people some things to think about. Let me know what you think about this in the comments. If you like what I do here, pick up a course at the academic agency, like and subscribe, join the channel, pick up a mug. But most importantly of all, get out. Well, hello everyone. In this video, I'm going to be outlining my case for why I think it is time to rebrand, for us to become the sensible centre. Now, over the past few years, I think a lot of us have been on an intellectual journey of discovery, figuring out exactly what we think on many different things. And we have done that under the rubric or under the label of dissident right. But the time has come for us to put that label away for various reasons, while retaining all of the things that we've learnt and presenting those ideas in a different way, a way I'm calling the sensible centre. Now, for those of you who are new to this channel, the quickest way to catch up with, you know, some of these ideas I'm talking about is to go to my Substack, The Forbidden Text. I recently put out an article called 59 Theses, which summarises many of the lessons that I have gone through, you know, in some detail over the past several years on this channel,
In my book, The Populist Delusion, in essays on my Substack and elsewhere. Now, back in August, I gave a talk called The Octopus, where the situation was looking pretty bleak because we had no institutions whatsoever on our side. The regime, as we tend to call the status quo or the powers that be, essentially control every single institutional castle on the map. However, all of that changed just a couple of weeks ago when Elon Musk finally completed his takeover of Twitter and then moved with a swiftness and rapidity that I think has shocked many of us to essentially capture this juvenilian castle on the map, namely Twitter, the most important and influential of the social media sites. We've always had a decent presence here on YouTube, but there's something about Twitter that gives it an extra special mimetic power, especially because, you know, anyone who is anyone is on Twitter, whereas YouTube is a slightly different experience. And this capture, even though it may seem quite small, that Elon Musk has taken this castle, represents an opportunity for us that did not exist a few months back. In August, when I wrote this speech, Twitter is one of many different nodes of opinion formation that exist in our society, but arguably it has become the most immediate and the most influential of all of those nodes. Obviously, the traditional media is still there, and YouTube, as I've mentioned, certainly helps push things one way or the other. But Twitter really, you could argue, was the platform that helped Donald Trump win the 2016 election. In fact, if he had not been on Twitter, one might argue whether he would have even run at all back in 2015. So for Musk to level the playing field and to give us this platform back represents an opportunity for us to, you know, set a tempo in the discourse, especially as the so-called blue check marks, the liberal elites, the spokespeople for the regime, are no longer going to get the artificial legs up that they used to have. Now, I also want to learn some of the lessons of what has gone wrong in the past and also look at people who have been successful in changing things, even though they've changed things in a direction that we did not like. For example, this sensible center strategy was used to very good effect in the late 90s and in the 2000s by Tony Blair. In this country. Now, of course, we don't like a lot of the changes that Tony Blair made, and, you know, he's not on our side, but essentially this was the tactic that he used. He managed to frame his opponents as extremists and to frame himself as the sensible guy in the room, whereas, in fact, as we all know, Tony Blair was extremely radical, left-wing, liberal, and you know, this was just a frame game that he was playing. In fact, as we'll see, Tony Blair and his ilk have always been the extremists, and people like us who disagree with them are now and have always been the sensible centre. This all started on Twitter just a couple of days ago when Sargon of Akkad, my buddy Carl Benjamin, came back. And, you know, we use Twitter. One of the things that people don't understand, I guess, especially those of you who only watch videos on YouTube or come to our streams and things like that, is that Twitter tends to be the space where we hash out a lot of ideas, you know, in rough form, or, you know, we kind of bounce things around, and then, you know, videos like this help cement it a little bit more. Essays and books are the kind of final form. So there's a process that come. So we're very much in the early stages here, but I wanted to make this video to explain really what I am trying to do, what Carl is trying to do. As I've said here, the dissident right is terrible branding. We must become the sensible centre. In fact, we already are the sensible centre. Now, I'm going to talk you through a series of these tweets that that I've made so you get the basic idea. So if you're not on Twitter, you can understand the sort of thing we've been doing for the past couple of days. And, you know, over the next year or so, I see things going more in this direction. And certainly I will put my efforts towards, you know, making this a kind of permanent change in the way that we present our ideas, in the way that we go about what we're doing. And there's all sorts of reasons why. If you stick with me right till the end of the video, I will explain what they are. So I said, I am abandoning the term postmodern traditionalist to embrace instead moderate centrist. That is since I kind of gone with sensible center instead, which I think is better branding in a way, because it, you know, it has what they call consonance. That's the sus sound, sensible center. And I think moderate has... Moderate suggests that you're moderating your views or kind of sacrificing some of your principles in a way. And we're not doing that. We are just presenting things that we believe in a different way. Okay. I said to be a postmodern in 2022 is a moderate view, and to be against wokeness, for immigration restriction, against democracy and so on defines the centre. And now, when we started bouncing this around, Dev, who is Carl's buddy, you know, he piped up and said, there's no way that you lads are centrist. To which I immediately replied, you're just extremely liberal. And that's okay. But actually, my views define the centre. And that is always how you must think about this. We represent the centre. Someone like Dev and his views represent extreme outliers. And I have data to show you how that is, in fact, the case. I'll show you that in a moment. Somebody else piped up, this chap, Richard Madden. He said, centrism is essentially globalist liberalism. I said, no, this is very wrong. Globalist liberalism is an extremist doctrine, alien to 99% of people anywhere. By any definition, it is far left. You must fully understand the extent of their extremism. We are the centre. And if you really want to understand the extent of their extremism, I spoke with a psychologist earlier this week called Josh Neal. I think it's Cigar Stream episode 155. He wrote a book called American Extremist, where he explores the extent to which this is actually true, that the, you know, that the liberals and the far left are the extremists and the rest of us are, by any definition in any era really, do define the moral majority and the centre of the society. We need to take the centre back from people who have gaslit you and gaslit us over the past several years. Here's Carl himself. He put out this tweet. Now, obviously, Carl has a huge account, a lot of engagement. He said, sensible centrism is reducing legal and illegal immigration to zero, abolishing hate speech laws, maintaining national sovereignty, purging wokeness from institutions, restoring the death penalty for severe crimes, promoting family values, and reducing the welfare state. And I will show you soon just how correct he is, that those views there, which a lot of people might think, oh no, this is right wing, or this is a kind of even far right. No, it's not. This is what most people believe in most countries, especially here in the UK and in America. There is a lot of data to say that all of these positions that Carl has outlined here are what the vast majority of people believe. And I just have a few other tweets here where I show the framing, the correct framing that we need to embody going forward. So extreme. We need to import 480,000 foreign students into our universities to keep them afloat. Sensible centre, university recruitment should be set by total demand for graduates. When 47% of graduates are in jobs that don't require degrees, we have too many students. And you can see that the establishment position is actually the extreme one, and our view is the sensible one. And it must always be framed in that way, regardless of what the issue is. And I have several other examples here. Extreme. There's a job shortage, so we need to import hundreds of thousands of people into the country and surrender our towns and cities to foreigners. Obviously an extreme view. I mean, not just on an historical scale, but also up until extremely recently, that was an extreme view here. No, if you'd said this sort of thing in, even in the middle of the Blair years, in like 2002 or something, people would not have gone along with this idea, and they would have thought that you were an extremist. The sensible centre view is, power is with labour. Let the wage rate rise. Do not let companies fob us off with the race to be the cheapest. And, you know, this is the sort of view that Jeremy Corbyn supporters may also have, or union trade union bosses, for example, may very well adopt a view like that. Extreme. Women can have penises. Men can need tampons. Sensible centre. No. And again, whichever way you look at it, the vast majority of people don't believe in the extreme position. They believe in the sensible one. That is why we embody and represent the centre. Extreme. We need to ignore the highest crime rate and murder rates in London on record to concentrate on the real problems, racism in the police. Sensible centre. We need to be tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Extreme. We need to run a massive managerial apparatus involving every single institution and staff overheads costing billions of dollars to protect the feelings of a small minority of people and ensure they don't feel offended. Sensible centre. No, we don't. Elon Musk, just in the past couple of weeks, has shown us. We don't need that. All of that apparatus was a waste of money. No, Twitter is now under his control and nobody has been affected. At all. So it is obviously the sensible view that we don't need any of that crap. Extreme. We need to keep immigration high because we can't fill all the jobs. Sensible centre. If you eliminated all the unproductive jobs, as Elon Musk did at Twitter, you'd open up a native labour supply to be reallocated to more productive ends. Extreme. Every person, no matter their interest or knowledge or productive input to society, should have a say in its running. Sensible centre. Obviously that's insane. And besides, every political party is an organised minority whose interests prevail over the disorganised mass. Extreme. There's no such thing as Indigenous Britons. Sensible centre. Yes, there is. They are people who have lived on this island for hundreds, I should have said thousands, of years, and who are recognised the world over. So, with each of these, you can see the framing puts the liberal on the foot of having an untenably extreme position. And it brings back the forces of common sense. It just kind of gives us the moral centre ground, which we do in fact have. Don't forget, they are the ones who are suggesting absurd things in many cases, which must be rejected by all right-thinking, sensible people. You can apply this to other things as well. Like, for example, my buddy Dave, the distributist, recently grew a moustache. And now an extremist would say keep it. But, of course, the sensible centre would recommend that he should shave it off. Now, just to show the power of this meme, strangely, literally less than 24 hours after me and Carl started tweeting in this way, Elon Musk put out this tweet. He said, "But freedom of speech is the bedrock of a strong democracy and must take precedence. My preference for the 2024 presidency is someone sensible and centrist. I had hoped that would be the case for the Biden administration, but have been disappointed so far." So you can see now Elon Musk, the richest man in the world and someone who obviously wields a lot of power, he is also using this frame of the sensible center. And if you have a look earlier on today, the Washington Post put out this story that billionaire Twitter owner Elon Musk said he would back Florida Governor Ron DeSantis if he runs for president in 2024. Tweeting into the night on Friday, Musk described DeSantis as a sensible and centrist choice. And if you go through each of the tweets I made about what is extreme and what is sensible, if Ron DeSantis was sitting here with me, or if indeed if Elon Musk was sitting here with me, they would, you know, maybe one or two, they may raise an eyebrow, but I reckon that in almost every single case, they would agree that those are sensible, centrist positions as against extreme liberal Antifa types who've taken over our institutions. So for all of these reasons, I'm saying we need to get rid of dissident right and we need to embrace the sensible centre. Now, what is the case for the sensible centre? Well, there's really four things that I will point to. First of all, it is a more honest framing of the current debate. It is more reflective of what is actually going on, which is a set of extremists are trying to change society in a direction that most people don't want it. And they're calling anybody who disagrees with them extremists, whereas in fact, they are the ones who are extremists. They are the ones who are trying to radically alter the way people live against the wills of those people. It's their job to convince us of their opinion. They have failed to do that. And given that we embody the centre, we are the ones who get to dictate who is extreme and who isn't. Secondly, it puts pressure on the left to show that they are not extremists. Something that I think, again, Elon Musk has done very well. Third, it will attract a higher quality of person. I'll get into that in a moment. And finally, it is more likely to achieve real-world results. Now, first thing to remember is the extreme liberal gaslight that has taken place through our media over the past 10 to 20 years. I will always use this example of Peter Hitchens on Newsnight. You can see there's a panel of five people there, of which Peter Hitchens represents just one person, one fifth of the panel. And every time Peter Hitchens would go on YouTube, would go on Question Time, the issue of immigration would come up, and Peter Hitchens would voice some very, very sensible centrist takes on what the limits of immigration should be, and really there are too many people here, that we don't need to have these ridiculous open border policies. And his fellow panellists, including the likes of Justine Greening, as you can see her there, who was meant to be a Tory MP, but in fact was an extremist liberal in disguise as a conservative, Will Self, the smug, grinning, long-winded author there, whoever the Labour person was, and usually they'd stick on a Lib Dem there as well, who of course is another extreme liberal. And what they would do on Question Time is when Peter Hitchens would voice his opinion on immigration, the other four panellists would kick into gear in condemnation of Hitchens to a braying and booing audience. So the little old lady who's sitting at home, who probably agrees with Peter Hitchens, was made to feel that her view was in the small minority, and that the views of the other four panelists were the majority, and the audience in the studio represented the majority. Whereas the truth is, and again we have data on this in the British Social Attitude Survey, that more than 60% of the British public have agreed with Peter Hitchens on this issue, going right the way back at no time. You know, there's a reason why people use the phrase "we were never asked," and that is because Hitchens does represent the sensible centre on this topic. It is just that the extremists have taken over the institutions. So that is the liberal gaslight. The reality of the sensible centre, however, is that Tory MPs, Conservative MPs, like the likes of a Justine Greening that we saw there, or David Cameron, or Boris Johnson, or any of these sorts of people, or Rishi Sunak, who's the Prime Minister now, are far to the left of where all voters are. You can see that all voters are to the right of the Conservatives on social issues. And another marker we could use for the reality of the sensible centre is the state of Florida, which back in 2000, if you remember, was the state that the Bush versus Gore election was held up on. Florida has always been a state that kind of takes the pulse of the nation in America, a swing state. Now that state solidly, by 60%, that's a majority of more than 20%, goes for the sensible centrist candidate Ron DeSantis, what has Ron DeSantis done? He ran on a stop woke platform. He ran on a platform to an anti-groomer bill. He was the one who took on the Walt Disney Company for pushing the child sex stuff. He's taken a firm stance on immigration. He has basically agreed with, let's say, 80-90% of the things that I have outlined so far, and he's put them into action as the governor of Florida. And you can see the results there. This is the same state, don't forget, that was voting 50-50 for Democrats just a few years ago. So it's not that the state of Florida has quote-unquote move to the right. It is that the Democrat Party have just become more and more extreme liberals, and so a sensible centrist candidate like Ron DeSantis is going to, you know, smash his opponent, as he has done here. So that is the reality of the sensible centre against the gaslight. Now, in a backdrop where this is the reality, do you want to brand yourself as the dissident right? Now, what happens when you call yourself a dissident right? What sort of people do you attract, as opposed to when you call yourself the sensible centre? You know, on the dissident right, you'll get an individual who looks like this guy on the left here, who's disaffected. He has learned helplessness. He's prone to unrealistic fantasy, adopting rigid ideologies, purity spiraling. He looks extreme to outsiders. It's very unattractive, and produces somebody like this. Now, that is not a positive frame for change in the direction that we want. Instead, we want somebody much more like the fella on the right here, who embodies the sensible centre. He's successful. He embodies will to power. He seeks realistic and achievable outcomes, not unrealistic fantasies that are never going to happen. And he is pragmatic as opposed to being ideological and rigid, because he's seeking real-world results. He's not thinking about pie-in-the-sky nonsense. And finally, outsiders want to be him. The chap on the left here is repellent. Okay, to the lizard brain, to any other person, he is repellent. You don't want to be like this guy. Whereas the guy on the right, He's everything that other people want to be. So it's attractive to embody this frame of the sensible centre. Now, note, none of the issues have changed. None of the way that we are, none of the things that we're actually advocating have changed. It is simply the presentation and the framing of those ideas that I'm talking about here, but that has real consequences for the sorts of people who, you know, might be attracted to it. If you call yourself dissident, you're going to get these terminally online people who just revel in being against the system. You know, they kind of embody this frame of the perpetual malcontent. And there's nothing you can do with somebody like that. You can't. If somebody is simply a malcontent or a disaffected youth, I mean, you know, back in my day, you might just say, well, that's just a loser. That's just, you know, you can't do anything with that. You need people who are serious. You need people who have achieved things and who want to achieve things in the future. People who are already have jobs in the professions, doctors, lawyers, you name it. These are the sorts of people, ideally, who we want to be getting on side now, especially as I mentioned, the richest man in the world, the most successful man in the world, you might say, also is on our side. So this should be an aspirational thing to join us. We are on the side of the positive change for the sensible centre. And there's something else that happens as well with the framing of these issues, because I think the very phrase dissident right kind of puts everybody in this competition for everyone to be, quote unquote, more base than everyone else. You know, you get these ridiculous purity spirals where everybody's trying to be more base than everyone else. You know, it's not just enough to, you know, talk about the differences between the two genders or some of the problems with women's rights or votes for women. You know, you then need to go, you know, a step further and a step further and a step further. And this is how you end up with things like white Sharia and things like this. Things that, frankly, are never, ever going to happen in a million years. Or you get the perpetual, oh, everything went wrong in the French Revolution. No, we need to go back to Cromwell. No, we need to go back to 1381 and all this sort of stuff. I mean, okay, it's an interesting academic argument, but ultimately it's unproductive and it leads to what I would describe as low quality across the board. It leads to, it kind of encourages, it encourages a spiral in a wrong direction, I would say. And that puts off people with the talent and the skills that could really help us going forward. The sensible centre, as a frame and as a label, in comparison, leads to a different type of competition where everybody is striving to be more sensible than everyone else, which will lead to high-quality individuals, productive framing for the issues, and it should attract people with talent and skill over to our side. Now, of course, newcomers are still going to have to learn all of the stuff I was talking about before. They can't just like come in and inhabit their old, you know, extreme liberal beliefs. There needs to be a program of making people more and more sensible. And if you're one of those people, I would encourage you to go through my back catalogue or read the entirety of my Substack or my book, The Populist Illusion. But yes, going forward, I think this is the best course of action. And it should, I think, I'm hopeful, will produce change in the direction that we want it. It won't give us everything that we want overnight, because, of course, that is an unrealistic fantasy, especially considering where we're starting from. But I think, looking at what has happened in the past couple of weeks, looking at the map, this is a sensible way forward. So, hope you're going to join us. for that. Still got my sale going on at the academic agency up until the end of this month. Promo code MERIT. That will get you 25% off all the courses. Join the channel. Read the Substack that I've mentioned and subscribe to that. I'm trying to put out more free articles to that, as well as paid content on there. And tell me what you think. Now get out.
Mike, ice cream so good. Thank you, Lopez. Slay, huh? Ice cream so good. Ice cream so good. Yes, 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 yes. Ooh, yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes, yes. Take you, Blake. Take you, Jace. Gang, gang. Take you, Josh. Take you, I don't know. Take you, Tay. Take you, I am. Ooh. Ooh. Yes, yes, yes. Gang, gang. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Gang, gang. Yes, yes, yes. Hum, hum, hum.
Damn, marshmallow. Crunchy corn. Yum. Kitty paws. Pumpkin. Yum.
Not spicy.
Ice cream, yum! Kitty boss, brrrr! Ice cream, yum! Once we get to 350, I'll leave, I promise. Stinky swear.
Not spicy.
Hot dog, yum! Hot dog, yum! Donuts, yum! I'm hungry.
Ask me if I'm a truck.
Are you a truck?
Ask me if I'm a truck.
Are you a truck?
Among several other things on Twitter, I'm probably known by some people for being like relentless in my dunking of Zoomers, right?
Yeah.
I have a pretty low opinion of the Zoomer, and I think the Nick Fuentes is in some way emblematic of this. You know, this kind of kid who's essentially got nothing to say. This is the thing that I find kind of simultaneously kind of fascinating, depressing, and infuriating, is that, you know, the internet has kind of democratized and leveled the playing field when it comes to anybody with a microphone now has a voice.
Yes.
Right? But the Zoomers, for me, are kind of like they're like a unique ground, like a kind of cultural and historical ground zero. Okay, so, you know, we talk about the boomers. The boomers had their own ground zero, right? I mean, I remember growing up in the 80s and the 90s, I was surrounded by boomer 60s culture.
Yes.
And I remember reading like Rolling Stone and things like that. And they would write in such a way that it was like, oh, the world was boring and gray. And there was just like Frank Sinatra and old crooners. And then it was Bob Dylan and the Beatles and rock and roll and the 60s had like invented culture. You know, there's that kind of boomer version of the ground zero, right? But even the boomer version of the ground zero had some semblance of connection with context. There's something happening here, right? But you don't know what it is, Mr. Jones, or whatever.
Right.
You know, you can just see it in the songs like Roll Over Beethoven or whatever. There was an element of self-consciousness that was going on with the boomers, because they at least had the privilege, I guess, looking back, of living in a time and place that was only just beginning to fall apart, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And from the European perspective, certainly was also trying to put itself back together after the tragedy of World War II, right? I mean, whichever side the country was, your country was on in that conflict, it was just absolutely devastating to the world order as it existed before 1945. And so a lot of what happened in the 60s can be seen as a kind of an attempt to find politics, they called it a post-war settlement, right? But that kind of happened on a cultural level as well. And there's all sorts of interesting things you can say about boomers. But for me, the Zoomer, each individual Zoomer is like their own ground zero.
Yeah.
But unlike the boomer who was doing something kind of interestingly countercultural, the Zoomer is so moronic and so lacking in even the basics of what I would call like basic cultural and historical knowledge, that any context of what they are doing socially and culturally is always already lost. And there's a lots of interesting ways in which this manifests itself. I remember a few years ago, you know, back when I was teaching in universities and so on, I had to design all of my courses in such a way that would essentially fill in all of the history that the students should have learned at school.
Right.
Because they just don't have it. Right. So anyone of our generation, Richard, has a kind of a basic idea, right? Well, you know, the Elizabethan era was here. Then you have, you know, like the English Civil War, the Restoration, something like the Enlightenment happened. Then you got the industrial, we've got kind of vague map of the shape of history in our minds, at least like which epoch goes where. You know, there's antiquity followed by the medieval era or something like that. But because of the way that a lot of history is taught in schools, which is very kind of modular, it's very modular, I found that students just didn't even have a basic kind of sense of that. You know, that, oh, you know, at this point you have the War of the Roses, and at that point you have the Tudors, and it just doesn't exist. They don't have the map, because essentially, I mean, certainly in British schools, they study periods in isolation. It's like you'll study the Nazis on their own, and then you'll do another module and you'll study, like, I don't know, Henry VIII on his own. All right, so that there's a very little sense of history being joined up in that way. Essentially, you cannot be postmodern, right? You cannot appreciate what the postmodern is if you can't even walk.
Like, right.
And you can't run before you've learned to even crawl. And this is another, I mean, part of it goes back to the way courses are constructed and things. I mean, I had radical feminist colleagues who were trying to like deconstruct they were trying to teach like the medieval literature was written by lesbian women before these kids had even done like Chaucer or something. It's like, well, this is going to mean nothing. Like, if you haven't done Shakespeare and Marlowe and so on, nobody's going to care about Lady Mary Roth. They just don't have in order to see something as transgressive or as challenging, you have to have a sense of what the status quo is. And my general comment is that I think the Zoomers are so lacking in any of those things, that things that are just kind of bog standard reactions that we might have, social transgressions, taboos, they just don't have it. They just don't have any, like, there's no filter. So when we see somebody like Nick Fuentes being outrageous and saying like crazy things and so on, it doesn't, like, it's like the Zoomers are so stupid they don't even know what they're doing, in a way, which can be a good thing and a bad thing. Like, they're immune to what I call like boomer truth regime kind of. They don't have any of the haloed stuff around World War II and, you know, the mid-century Germans and so on. But on the other hand, it's like, well, you might as well be dealing with a chimpanzee or something. It's just like you're dealing with a caged animal who has no sense of anything. You can just poke them around and they'll jump about and you can laugh at them. This is my honest view. I mean, to give you an example, Richard, I have a set of tweets I do sometimes, where, you know, sometimes on Twitter you're just kind of talking and you'll throw out a reference to something. You know, I might casually mention Al Pacino or something. And then what I've started doing is I follow that up with a tweet that says, "Four Zoomers, Al Pacino is an actor. And what I'll do is I'll mix in obviously false information with kind of well-known things.
Right.
As a kind, right. And then what is stunning about these, because obviously to me or to you, these would be like kind of funny little tweets that, because yeah. You know,
you're like Al Pacino, former prime minister of Italy.
Yeah, exactly.
During First World War.
there was a story with the Rolling Stones the other day, as Mick Jagger's now going out with like an 18-year-old or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
Or like some girl in her 20s.
Yeah.
And I just quote tweeted and said, you know, maybe he gives his satisfaction. And then I said, well, for Zoomers, tweet is a pun. Mick Jagger is in a band called the Rolling Stones. One of their famous songs is Satisfaction. Satisfaction is when you have sex. Sex is something done between two consulting adults that you've only seen in porn. A pun is a play on words. You understand the kind of basic formula.
Wow.
But what's incredible about these tweets is that Zoomers then, without any sense of irony or self-awareness or anything, reply saying, oh, I think I knew that, or, oh, thanks for telling me, I've never heard of Mick Jagger. it's kind of mind-blowing. I just don't, like, and I'm not talking about, you know, you could say, well, all right, I wasn't born in the 80s, so I don't know who, I don't know, the second member of Wham is or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking about, like, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, yeah. Marlon Brando, you know, just, like, basic stuff that everybody knows, that they just don't.
Yeah.
And it, to me, that makes them simultaneously, like, fascinating, sad, and also terrifying, because they just don't react to anything in the way that you might expect, because they're just not fully socialized. It's kind of like a systematic failure. You've got a generation of people who just essentially aren't finished. And I think that Nick Fuentes is, I think the reason that he's popular only really with those people. I don't think he has any crossover to anybody who comes from the before times. He's like a pure creature of
yeah.
Zoomer internet, who speaks really only to Zoomers. And, you know, they say like the first time is tragedy, the second time is farce, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's a difference between Charlottesville and what happened in that moment and this thing that we've been talking about with the Fuentes phenomenon and so on, which is that, you know, for better or for worse, back in 2016, 2017, when you put that Pepe Frog on, there was a degree of self-awareness
yeah.
going on with you, okay? You're a man who's grown up watching Seinfeld or whatever, like you understand, like you have a degree of sophistication where you actually understood to some extent what was happening and the social, political, and cultural context mm-hmm. of that. And that when you're transgressing, you're actually know why and, you know, what, like, if something is edgy, you know what that line is and why you're crossing it, for better or for worse. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Nick crowd, I do not believe has that level of awareness. I just don't think they know what they're doing. It's like a kind of,
you think they're not ironic in some weird,
I just don't think they have any concept of any of those things. They just lack the necessary knowledge, basically, to understand what they're actually doing. Now the actual effect, when Louis Theroux puts Nick Fuentes on a BBC documentary and middle-class women in bloody, you know, Kent mm-hmm. listen to him saying that women shouldn't have the vote and all this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah.
That is probably very traumatizing to them.
Yeah.
Right? But I just don't know if Fuentes understands why that reaction would happen. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he does. Maybe I'm not giving him enough credit. But I just don't get the impression that there's the ability to distinguish between a kind of edgelord online space and just the real world and its real taboos and its, and you know, actual moral values that people have. You know, I've talked a lot. My next book is going to be called Boomer Truth Regime.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm going to talk about, like, well, this is a kind of mental prison in a way for boomers and Gen Xers and millennials who have all lived their lives in this kind of ideological kind of post-World War II bubble that in some ways is kind of liberal and free, but in other ways is extremely brittle.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there are whole topic areas that we can't even talk about without getting into trouble, right?
Well, I think I think that you're onto something because, so if we briefly describe the generations, you obviously the boomers had this very unique perspective of being born after the Second World War and experiencing its benefits and kind of developing the taboo, which might have existed previously to some extent, but really develop, you know, Hitler is the worst thing ever. The Holocaust is the most kind of profound event that we could think about. Liberalism's good, you know, and so on. Gen Xers, we kind of reacted against that as their children, where it's the kind of Christopher Hitchens, you know, well, okay, but you know, Israel just uses the Holocaust so they can oppress Palestinians. Like we had a little sense of, and I'm a young Gen Xer, but I am a Gen Xer. But we kind of had a sense of irony. The millennials almost like reinstated the boomer truth regime.
Yeah, it was like,
in a kind of funny way.
Gen Xers, I mean, I call it the Gen X Daria. Do you remember that show Daria?
Oh yeah, yeah. I do.
You know how she was like cynical and she'd be like always kind of psychoanalyzing her parents and,
yeah,
you know, she'd never be impressed with it. I mean, that's very stereotypical kind of Gen X.
Yeah.
It's Bill Murray, basically, you know.
Yeah. But then, like, millennials almost reinstated it in this kind of cutesy way. And then, I think Gen Z, they're almost like, they really are. Because if you look at the like political profile of millennials and Zoomers, it's actually very similar in terms of like, do you support gay marriage? Do you support abortion? Do you support taxes or whatever? They're actually very similar and they're very left wing. But I think there might be a profound difference that polling misses, where it's like someone like Pearly Things or Nick Fuentes, where they're just like, yeah, women shouldn't vote, women have no value. They're just saying this directly, unadulterated on social media. That's a difference. I don't think it's millennial would do that.
No, I mean, millennials were extremely, I taught a lot of millennials and they were extremely earnest and, you know, it's difficult. I mean, I'm kind of on the cusp, you know, I'm either a late Gen X or an early millennial, you call it, mm-hmm. the Xennial, right?
Yeah.
Kind of unique and early. I was born in the early 80s. But the kind of, certainly the later millennials, they don't deal with ambiguity very well. You know, I remember teaching Shakespeare and they wanted to know, like, who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. I'm like, you can't approach Shakespeare like it's Harry Potter, you know? But they almost wanted to make everything Harry Potter, like genuinely a battle of good against evil, which is interesting in all sorts of ways.
Harry Potter and Marvel movies.
The Gen Z, the Zoomers, as we've been talking about, I think what it is that I genuinely don't think they have any sense of what you might call the sacred, right?
Yeah.
Now, like, you and I, we might start to question some of the, like you mentioned, like the uses of the Holocaust in kind of post-World War II myths, something like that. And you can look at it with a kind of jaundiced eye.
Mm-hmm.
But we also will have an acute sense, especially if you're just talking to a Joe Normie, member of the public, that this is an absolute kind of sacred symbol at the center of the system. And that you have to tread really carefully around that because, you know, people can, if you tread on their sacred symbol, they can go absolutely apeshit. And, you know, when it comes to that particular issue, you know, it's, you know, you're dealing with some pretty untouchable areas, right? But I don't feel like the typical Zoomer, and certainly not Nick, I don't think he gets that. I don't think he gets that when he's making his cookie jokes or whatever, that this is going to be like, I mean, it has the effect, like he probably sees the horrified reactions and so on and thinks they're funny or whatever. But I don't think he quite understands the depth of how sacred that value is. Or like, I don't know, women's votes or something like that. Like,
right.
So, I mean, see, it's a weird thing because in a strange way, it's liberating, right? But they're almost trying to achieve what I want to achieve with my Boomer Truth stuff, just in the most retarded way possible. They're just doing it by being retarded, mm-hmm. not by any kind of knowing deconstruction. And I find myself kind of torn because, in a strange way, I also like want to. How can I put it? Like, as I want to tear down the world the Boomer's built. I want to also want to kind of retain some part of it or appreciate some part of it because it's the world we grew up in, right? But they just don't have any semblance of any of it. Another attitude I come across a lot from the Zoomers is that, oh, we live in such a, like a morally bankrupt world. Basically all art produced after the war is degenerate. You know, you'll talk about a movie or something. Oh, why would I need to know that? It's degenerate. Degenerate. You know,
or it's a Jewish author. Like, oh, yeah. I'm glad I don't have to read that book.
So you essentially get Zoomers justifying their own ignorance of everything. It's like they're proud of not knowing anything.
Yeah.
Which is a very... So that's one thing.
And their sacred objects come from the internet. So...
But this is the other thing, though, Richard.
Yeah.
This lack of a sense of what is sacred... Okay, also means you get ridiculous Road to Damascus conversions every 6 weeks. You know, I'm a pagan Nietzschean.
Right.
6 weeks later, now I'm a devout Catholic. Six weeks later, now I've joined the Orthodox Church. It's just like, do you understand the magnitude of these declarations you're making? You know, I remember that, like Thomas Carlyle says, the most important thing about a man is his religion, right?
Yeah.
But these people wear them like clothes.
Yeah.
And they declare them to the world, and they change their avatars, and they get into all of the all of the ortho bro talk, and then 6 weeks later they're onto something else.
Ask me if I'm a truck.
Are you a truck?
Ask me if I'm a truck.
Are you a truck?
Hey guys, it's the Loud Guys. Today we are going to react to Bohemian Rhapsody, song sung by the band Queen. Ah! That's the best switch up yet. With your big headed crew, with your narrow minded crew, to the skies and sea. That's the best switch up yet. That's the best switch up yet. Damn, did I listen to this? I could have swore I did. I could have sworn I listened to this a couple years ago, bro, but I don't, yeah, maybe, I don't know. I could have swore I did. Tripping around. So you think you can love me and leave me to die?
Is he home? Is he home?
I used to hear that at the party. It's like, what in the world these white people got playing right
now? Yeah, I was just like, what the hell? The first time I heard it, bro, I was so confused.
It's one of the best songs of all time, gentlemen. Yeah, you guys are disrespectful, uncultured.
I'm sorry.
And y'all remember the best songs of all time?
Oh my gosh, yeah, that was insane, man.
Mama mia.
So is Queen the best band of all time?
Well, that's crazy.
And he was talking about catching a bite.
I mean, bro,
they got the
most bangers.
Maybe. We are the champions. Is actually
they're one of the most classic bands.
Another one.
Wait.
That's Ice Ice Baby.
That's Ice Ice Baby.
That's Ice Ice Baby. I know that for facts.
I mean, one of the things about this that is clearly just made up. These people have been at this for many years now, 2-3 years. They never once thought, oh, well, I quite like this song by this band. I quite like the song by Radiohead. I quite like the song by Queen. I'm going to take the logical step of checking out the next song and the next song and maybe the whole album. But no, it doesn't occur to these people to do that. It's always their first time listening to something. I'm calling bullshit on this. Absolute bullshit.
They melt it back together? Is that a thing? Is that possible?
I'm here to finish your training.
Fully grown adult.
Oh, look at this guy. Who does he think he is?
It's happening.
Tell you what, you're going to switches back and forth read those books. You want to get down the gym, mate, you fat bastard.
I had to
fight
a drag queen for the last black eye.
Shouldn't you want out to vote?
You want to get outside and
you can hear
touch
that?
Some grass. Look at the grass.
We don't live ask questions. In the ashes of civilization.
And then get excited for next product.
Look, I'm touching grass.
You little baby.
Grass. I'm touching the grass.
Is she younger?
It's young Ahsoka.
That's young Ahsoka.
No, they upload these videos. This is my first.
The trouble with these YouTubers, mate, is that they just think they know everything and they don't.
First time in all my 24
years. They haven't been to the school of life, these guys.
Radiohead. Here's my live reaction. Yay, there's a new Star Wars coming out.
I've ever witnessed.
Look at them, they got 200, 300, 400, 500,000 people watching this episode
right here already.
Loyalty to Disney.
Well, if you can't beat them, join them. I thought, well, you know, if this is the game on YouTube now, I better join in.
Everybody shut up. With his books. He thinks he knows something because he's read them.
Appreciate what we're having right now.
Arrogant little sob.
All right. That'll do. That's enough. Get out, everybody.
The best switch up yet.